Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Stephen DeLuque.
And this is Krista Hewitt.
We are the co-hosts of Ears on Art, with a special program commemorating our 13th anniversary of being on the air.
Ears on Art is produced here at the studios of KCBX Public Radio for the California Central Coast. A little hard for us to fathom, but 1999, April 1st, no fool, we began Ears on Art. So today we celebrate our 13th anniversary. Pretty exciting, huh, Stephen?
It really is exciting. After all, we weren't given much hope for a great show in those days, and a lot of people were very skeptical as to what this program was going to be about.
Many of you, from your responses, have let us know that we've been successful at helping people get a little better feel of the arts, the visual arts specifically, and maybe how they come to be. Today, our format's going to be a little bit different. We're going to start with the answer to our most commonly asked question.
What was it? What was that spark that got you interested and motivated to become an artist?
Here are Donald Archer and Laurie Slater from Cambria, two painters, giving their response.
As a child, I loved to draw, but I loved to draw with a sharpened pencil. So by the time I got into grammar school, the teacher tried to get me to paint, and I wouldn't paint at all because I wanted to have the precision. A brush was too big. I like to look at things, and I like to observe things and copy things. In a world in which we feel that we have very little control, the arts are one area in which an individual can have total control. I wanted to create a world that I envisioned, which wasn't always the world that I lived in.
Laurie?
Like most children, I was drawing at an early age, and I, contrary to Donald's experience, just could not wait to get at that easel in kindergarten. And I've been painting and drawing ever since, always making art and loving it.
We found over the years that virtually 90% of the artists that we interviewed stated that they became interested in the arts in very, very early childhood.
There were some exceptions, and usually that meant that somehow this introduction didn't happen until college. But wherever it was, it all seemed to have rather the same effect, that it changed their lives.
It's interesting how many of them also stated that creating artwork is more of a conversation than a lecture. The materials talk back to you as much as you try to control them and use them.
And certainly there were others who emphatically let all of us know that there was no choice in the matter for them. This was something that they just have to do.
It was part of their conversational process.
One of the very articulate people we'll listen to next, his name is Bruce Beasley. He's a sculptor, internationally known, who lives in Oakland. And we talked to him on the occasion of his 45-year retrospective that took place at the Oakland Museum of Art. Bruce started his interest in just building things as a kid, but as you will hear, this certainly expanded. In the background, you're going to hear his sprinklers, not the first additional sound that we have put up with over the years. Crows, other birds, barking dogs. It's all just part of the process of going on site, which, of course, we love to see the studio, so it's perfect.
Dartmouth did not have a practicing art program at that time of any serious level, but they had a beginning drawing class. And I took that and enjoyed the drawings, but the final exam for the class was 50 independent drawings. I don't know what possessed me, but I asked the professor if I could do 10 models instead. And I did that, and it was an epiphany for me, because I'm not saying that they were good pieces, but the discovery that I could make something in 3D, in the world, with my hands and struggling with my own thoughts that spoke a human emotional language in shape and form was just exhilarating. And based on that, something went click in a way that nothing had before, and I said I was going to be a sculptor.
Stephen, I know you work mostly two-dimensionally with paint and in the past printmaking and certainly drawing, but does what Bruce has said strike a chord with you?
It does indeed. I have been known in the past to do what I call painting constructions, which are actually 3D freestanding paintings. And I've also experimented in the past with three-dimensional works themselves. As a matter of fact, I find myself now moving into, although still two-dimensional, completely non-objective paintings, which I have never attempted before. So I think every artist goes through an evolutionary process with it, with their works and with their techniques.
I remember having a conversation with Bella Feldman, who we will hear from in a little bit, another sculptor, talking about her body of work over several decades and if she had felt that it was still recognizable as hers, something from 40 years ago versus something done yesterday. And she said that she was actually kind of pleased and surprised to see that it did all still work together, that it all, as she said, came from the same person. And yet we certainly are often trying to find new vocabularies and new way to say things.
The way of expressing artistic creation is ever-changing. And I think that most artists find that that change is motivational, that keeps them going, keeps them interested in their own works.
I realized that when I started working with silver, and it was very easy to become enamored with a polished surface, and that over the years, I've really become intrigued with a whole different approach to texture, which often does not involve high reflective surfaces. And now work seems kind of plain when I'm not using that. So it isn't anything that in 1969 I would have thought necessarily was part of me. And it's been exciting to discover it.
It's your new vocabulary.
Exactly. The other thing that we have talked about with quite a few people is that crossover with different materials and therefore in some ways different vocabularies depending on techniques and other things that we need to learn. And I've been really fortunate, I think, to have had as much exposure as I've had to these different processes. And part of what it keeps telling me is how much a lot of things are the same, even though I might be working in marble or I might be working in wood or in metal. Or if I'm taking a photograph, I do realize that those have opened up new doors but also helped me see that my path is definitely mine and has a continuum to it that's very enriching. I certainly started my creative explorations at a young age. A lot of them had to do with my father, who loved to work with all sorts of materials and fortunately was very willing to include this little kid in the process. I was holding tools for him or learning how to lay bricks on the back patio or painting a barbecue, whatever it was, there was a hands-on approach. When I was 18, which was 10 years after he had died, I took my first ceramics class at Cal State Northridge. To this day, I remember walking out of that studio. It was probably around 5 in the evening, kind of warm as it can be in the San Fernando Valley. I had clay stuck to my pants and shirt, and there was just this euphoria that came over me, and it was a feeling of connection with my father, but it was also a feeling of I have made a different kind of connection. I have gotten in touch with something that I really needed to find. When Bruce talks about that epiphany, I guess that is perhaps what I was having at that moment as well.
I began drawing at a very, very young age. And when my family moved to England in 1959, I was 7 years old. In those days, art was still taught in the classroom, as the budgets would allow it to be. And I remember one time that my teacher at the little two-room schoolhouse that I attended, she wanted to submit one of my drawings into a national competition. I was an extremely shy child, and I told my parents that I didn't want her to do that. And my parents told me, point blank, she goes, well, you're probably not going to win, so why don't you just go ahead and let her do it? And so I agreed. And it turns out that I actually won the competition for my age group. And although most of us don't look for that kind of reward in our artwork, as a matter of fact, it's one of the few things that I really don't look for when I'm creating a piece of artwork, it really was an impetus for me to keep doing what I was doing and to maintain my interest in the arts.
Stephen, I've been really impressed over the years when I think back of how many of our guests have given not just the two of us, but our listeners, a little insight into not exactly why they're doing what they're doing in terms of an individual piece, but some of the how, technically and emotionally. I'll go back to Bruce Beasley, and we can listen now to his statement of a process that he currently uses when he's forming one of his large, highly detailed, in terms of their angles, geometric forms.
I don't see images in my head. I don't see finished pieces that I then just go and make. So I start just arranging shapes, and at first nothing's happening. In other words, it's like playing notes on the keyboard, and God, it's all just awful. And then some little thing happens, some little clink that's a little interesting. And then I'll add something to it or try to go in that direction. But it's as though I'm discovering the sculpture, or it's as though I'm bringing it to life. And at first, it's like it's dead. Nothing's there. But eventually, something happens. And really, it's like it comes to life a little bit. But it's awkward and isn't fully formed. And then my job is to find it and complete it. But it's more like I'm helping it and discovering it than I am creating it. And then what happens is it will have come to life, but it's as though there's too much. It's as though it's a little confused. And then I start removing things and to see how much I can remove before I kill it. Because the last shape, when I can start taking shapes out, and okay, no, it's still alive now. I take out another shape. Okay, it's still alive now. When I take out the last shape, and then it's dead, then I put that last shape back in because I want it to be just as minimum as it can be and still be alive. I think the creative impulse is common. So whether it's music or dance or poetry or painting or sculpture or whatever, what then differs is which way it pulls us. So I think that in effect, sculptors are just, we're just the ones that want to be poets with shapes, and the musicians are the ones that want to be poets with notes, and the poets are the ones that want to be poets with words, and the dancers are the ones that want to be poets with motion, and so on. But I think that what we all have in common and why we understand each other basically is that the impulse is the same.
If you have just joined us, you are listening to Ears on Art, a program produced at the studios of KCBX, serving the Central Coast of California. Today's guest that we're listening to right now is Bruce Beasley, who is discussing the universality of the creative process.
I think that for me, abstract sculpture was like discovering a language that I didn't know I knew. It was just so natural. I mean, after all, we live in a world of shape. We're moving through shapes all the time. I think that our whole relationship with the world is one of shape. So therefore, making a conscious language of shape is talking to people about something that they really do know, but they don't know they know it.
Throughout these 13 years, there certainly have been some common questions, as we've already alluded to. A common theme, which often hasn't been asked directly, but is always there, has to do with the definition of art. I think, Stephen, that we've really worked hard to allow listeners to form much of their own opinion about that. Occasionally, it's fun to go back and listen to somebody that we think really nailed it. So here again is Bruce Beasley, the sculptor from Oakland, who discusses that very theme.
I decided a long time ago that to incorporate a qualitative judgment or a qualitative part with the word art is a fundamental mistake. Because then all it means is saying is art means I like it. And there is lots of bad art made, but it's art. And so I think it's a complete mistake to get into the qualitative with the art. I think that art is a complex process that human beings do that's difficult to precisely define, but has to do with wanting to talk about human feelings through music or dance or painting or sculpture or what. And much of that does not connect. Much of it is mediocre, but it's art because it's all trying to do that. And so anyone who's trying to do that is an artist. And it is some other filtering process that brings out work that people do respond to more. Mm-hmm. But it is a complete mistake to say that's not art and that is art if it comes out of an expressive intent. So the most beautiful rock is never art. The most beautiful sunset is never art. Art is a human activity, and it has relationship to nature. But the most beautiful nature may be more beautiful than any art can be, but it is not art. Art is an intentional human activity, but not all of it is wonderful. That's right. Actually, art is a intent. That's very good. That'll help me in the future with this. Art is not a result. Art is an intent. And therefore, anything that has that intent is art. Does all the intent succeed? No. Does it end up with the result hoped for? No. But you start off, everything starting off up here is art. That's the intent. And in the same way that we shouldn't use the term as applause for something else done very well. So, for instance, he makes an art out of cutting the lawn. That's trying to say he does a very good job of cutting the lawn, but it's not art. We lose the sense of what it really can mean when we say that. We shouldn't overly worship the term, nor should we use it too casually to gold plate something that's just a good job.
When I heard Bruce first make that comment, I found myself just going, whoa, the use of the word intent really does make a difference. Does that say anything to you, Stephen, or am I just kind of out here on a limb?
I think he put it very beautifully in the fact that all pieces of artwork begin with an intent, and then they take us on this journey of creative discovery as we go through the process of taking it from the idea and then making it into a piece of art. For each of us, that journey is usually quite individual, quite unique. We all use varying types of processes in which to get there, but it is indeed that spark of an idea that is the beginning of the journey.
Frequently in my years, both in education and as a student, have the question asked of me, well, what is your statement with your work? That just often left me with the sense that somehow I was considered to be very different if I didn't have an immediate answer to that question.
I've always felt that the artwork is in and of itself the statement, and that you didn't have to have a justification or an explanation as to what it was that you were attempting to say.
Okay, so in that, my intent may be something that I work very hard to verbalize through the actual work, but not verbalize with the use of the English language.
Exactly. I've always felt that if someone has to explain to you why a piece of art is an excellent work, then it probably isn't. It should be able to say that to you on its own merit.
Sometimes in your paintings, you have chosen to make very contemporary political statements. And then I see another work where I would have to read really hard to find what the chicken was saying to me about the current, world of politics. So you seem to be able to move back and forth in that realm. I'm intrigued often of how wide a spectrum you're able to include in terms of how you approach subject matter.
It's interesting that you mentioned those two bodies of work, because I worked on them simultaneously. And it was the chicken paintings that kept me sane, because I was dealing with such emotional and what I felt violent imagery through the political paintings. So when it got to be so overwhelming for me, I'd sit back and paint a chicken.
Yay! They have a certain amount of just real humor to them when you really sit and watch them. So I could see how that might be a real outlet.
It was.
Our next guest is Bella Feldman, also a sculptor and currently actually getting into some printmaking. She, too, is from Berkeley, Oakland area, taught for many years at California College of Arts and Crafts, now known as California College of Art. And she had an exhibit at the San Luis Obispo Museum of Art about a year ago. When she was here, we talked to her. And one of the questions that I asked her was what she hoped to achieve as a teacher.
How to express themselves as clearly and as interestingly as possible. I mean, everybody has a story to tell, but they can't always tell it in an interesting way. And if they don't tell it in an interesting way, it's not interesting to anybody else. And I did feel that art is a question of communication. One-liners obviously are kind of communication, but then they're too simplistic. So I'm more interested in the kind of communication that comes with poetry, where you there are layers of meaning and the viewer or the reader gets to bring their own experience to them. But it is communication. And also to problem solve. Every work of art you make is a different problem. The answers aren't handed to you, and that carries over into life. So it's a whole bunch of things: how to think clearly, how to express yourself clearly, and how to do it in an interesting way, and hopefully to have something that's original. I mean, we all are similar, but if we can reach deeply enough and more knowledgeably enough into what we have to say, there's a certain originality, an expansion of thought that comes with it. And it's that expansion of thought that you hope for. It doesn't always come, but
exactly. But there again, if we could put all of those things in words, then we wouldn't do them, or we wouldn't need to do them.
You can't really put it into words. It helps to talk about it. I must say I appreciated teaching because it gave me an opportunity to talk about art, and I think artists need to do with that more than they do, certainly in California. You can't ever really approach the art, but I do think it speeds your thinking if you can discuss your ideas with others of similar bents and interests. There's a language that comes from object making that you can't get any other way. Materials talk back to you. And I think if your conceptual art can be very interesting, but it's from the brain outward, it's not ever, you're not really letting something come in and congeal and ferment in your own brain creative juices. It's not as much of a dialectic.
Mm-hmm. Okay, problem solving. I'm not a mathematician, so what are we talking about here?
That's a really great question. I think that every artist at one time or another comes up against a brick wall while working on a particular project or artwork. And problem solving to me is recognizing, number one, that there is a problem, and number two, how do you fix it? And that's not such an obvious thing.
There's fixing sometimes within the piece, and occasionally fixing means just having to begin again because you really hit a brick wall.
That's absolutely true. When I hit a really, really bad stump, I simply put the canvas down and I can walk away from it. And sometimes I walk away for months. And when I come back to it, usually the problem becomes more obvious to me. And I'm able to go in there and then correct it. But then you can also, in that process, go in and ruin it. So you have to have a sense of fearlessness about these things.
I remember so well one day in Italy, and I'd been working on a piece of marble, and it had a skin on the surface that was a wonderful color and texture, and I was trying very hard to not cut all of that away as I had always done in the past and polish the piece up. I wanted to keep that contrast. And in trying to keep that, I had been very cautious about where I was cutting. And I went away for lunch knowing that somehow the piece wasn't there yet. And I came back and realized that I just had to be willing to take some risks. And for the next 4 hours, time just disappeared. It was so exciting because I really allowed the rock to talk to me and me to talk to it.
And I think also you have to lose that sense of preciousness, that everything that you create is precious and deserves to be preserved in some way, shape, or form. Once you start adapting that kind of philosophy, I think that creates fear. You become afraid of making a mistake, and that will stop you dead in your tracks.
Sometimes, as you were indicating, there's the luxury of being able to put a piece aside for a day, a week, a year. And other times, you're up against a deadline. And so then you're really having to make decisions about how can I rescue this? How can I turn a corner and take it in a different direction? There's that kind of problem solving. And then there's how do I make this actually work? If there's a functional aspect to it, a hinge I might be making, or the piece needs to stand up. What a surprise if it's a piece of sculpture. Or hang on the wall, or you often are combining canvases, and how am I going to make those transitions? So,
having to obey the laws of physics, we all got to do it.
Gravity, gravity, gravity. The reality that placing oneself in the position of having to solve problems is something that is useful throughout our lives. And therefore, when you're studying art where they're not exact answers all the time to a problem and you have to find the confidence to do it, seems to warrant some merit as far as the value of why people should be playing around with this stuff.
Because you go through this process with every artwork, you have to continue problem solving, recognizing the problems, identifying them, correcting them. It also builds in a tremendous amount of confidence in your own abilities. And I think that is something, at least for me, that art has taught me. It's great to have the freedom to fail, because even through failure, you're learning.
We could probably pontificate on this for a long time, and we certainly hope that all of you out there will have fun thinking about these things.
And as artists, we think about it probably a little bit too much.
Thank you all for being around all these 13 years, in and out, wherever you've been. But we know that you have appreciated it because you've told us so, and that has meant a great deal to us.
We wouldn't be here if it were not for the feedback that we get from our listeners, and we thank you for that attention.
Our guests today come from previous programs. They have been Donald Archer and Laurie Slater from Cambria, Bruce Beasley, and Bella Feldman, both from Oakland.
And you have been listening to Ears on Art, produced here at the studios of KCBX in San Luis Obispo, serving the central coast of California. This is Stephen DeLuque.
And Krissa Hewitt.
Join us next week when we discuss the concept and the creation of a phantom gallery. Thank you so very much for listening.